Well, aloha, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. We are not in Hawaii. It's very cold in here, but I'm Ralph Kasa, the head of the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu. I'm delighted to be able to moderate this panel today, and what we want to do is share with you the efforts of some efforts at looking at cross-strait confidence-building measures that were undertaken under Bonnie Glaser's guidance as a collaborative project between CSIS here in Washington and the Pacific Forum CSIS in Honolulu. I have to commend Bonnie at the outset for a dual confidence-building measures effort. There's sort of, you know, the island-mainland competition between the Pacific Forum and CSIS, and then there's the that other island-mainland competition that that we're here to focus on. So Bonnie has helped to bring the both sides of CSIS together, the renegade province from Honolulu and the home office, and we're absolutely delighted to be able to collaborate with Bonnie on this effort. The effort is based on a very firm belief that I think many people in this room share, that there is a window of opportunity right now for cooperation between the mainland and Taiwan that hasn't existed in the last few years. You can spend a lot of time in very fruitless debate as to whose fault it was or why it was that that opportunity didn't exist. But the point is that today there is a new environment. I think as part of our trip where we went to both Taipei and to Beijing in April, which was sort of that interim period between the KMT, Ma Ying-jeou election and the inauguration, that there was, I think, an understanding on both sides and a desire on both sides to sort of seize the opportunity, the sort of the new era. And what we have in our report and what Bonnie will review in just a couple of minutes is some of the recommendations that came out of our discussions, recommendations for the U.S., but primarily for China and for Taiwan on how to seize this opportunity. Phil Saunders, who was part of our group, will also provide some of his insights and also share with us some of the work that he's been doing on the peace regime or peace accord between the two sides as sort of an added dimension of our discussion today. I would also mention that Renata Louie, who is in the audience, was another member of our group. And if there are any hard questions, we'll call on Renata to answer those. So we're glad that you're here with us as well. I would tell you my own very brief conclusion that I reached in talking with both sides, and that's that there is a desire to move forward, but there's also a certain degree of caution on both sides. Each side is sort of still sort of feeling out just what are the other possibilities and the limitations. But the real sense that I have is that there is a sense of urgency or a sense of need for some early deliverables from the Taiwan side that is not fully appreciated on the mainland. One of the discussions that I had with some of the folks on the mainland, separate from this meeting here, one of the conclusions that our Chinese colleagues reached was we can sort of work on economic cooperation now, and then the more sensitive issue of international space we can deal with during Ma's second term. And they were not particularly pleased by my response, which was there won't be a Ma second term if there isn't some movement during the first term on some of these sensitive issues. So I think that part of the challenge that we're going to face as we move forward on this is to perhaps increase the sense of urgency in a China that, at least when we were there, and probably up until very recently, was quite frankly preoccupied with the Olympics preparation, with Tibet, with the earthquake, and et cetera, et cetera. One would hope now that with those things behind them, that China will be looking for an opportunity to move forward, and some of the recommendations and this report would help them do that. I think most people know both of our panelists, but I'll just mention very briefly that Bonnie Glaser is a senior associate here at CSIS. She's now working with the China chair, had been Freeman chair on China studies, and previously had been with the International Security Program. She's also a senior associate with the Pacific Forum CSIS. She helps to bridge that gap and writes the chapter on U.S.-China relations and our comparative connections quarterly journal. Anyone who is not on distribution for our either our weekly PACnets or our quarterly journal, please slip me your email address at the end of the day, and I'll be happy to put you on distribution. I'm not selling subscriptions. It's a free journal available on the Internet, so we're happy to have you join us. On the flip side, Phil Saunders has previously been at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies and in Monterey and is now at INSS, Institute for National Strategic Studies at National Defense University, but of course is here in his private capacity, not speaking for the U.S. government or NDU, but also providing his unique insights. With that, let me turn it over to Bonnie, and then we'll go to Phil next. Bonnie.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you all.
Sure.
That's a good idea. Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming.
This was sort of protective cover if anyone was going to throw anything, so now you're exposed, Bonnie. Good luck.
I'd like to start by saying a few words of appreciation to several people. First, to all the members of the delegation, and you will find that there is a list, one of the appendices in the back of the report, that has a list of all of the delegation members. There were a total of 15, and each one of the delegation members brought expertise and insights to the discussions that we had. I blame none of them, however, for any of the analysis or the conclusions in the report. The report was authored by Brad Glosserman and me, and so we take full responsibility. I'd like to thank Ralph and the Pacific Forum, and certainly thank Brad for his collaboration, though unfortunately he was unable to be here today.
So we'll blame him for any mistakes.
Okay. Right. Okay. Whatever we got right, I take credit for. Our hosts in Taipei and in Beijing, in Taiwan, we were hosted by the Foundation on International and Cross-Strait Studies and had great cooperation from TECRO and the Foreign Ministry. And our host in Beijing was the China Foundation for International Strategic Studies. And, of course, you'll also find an agenda list of participants, people that we met with in the other appendices. Assistance and work that my colleagues did here was really indispensable. Want to thank Derek Mitchell for all of his editing suggestions on the report, and Allison Slack, one of our great research associates, who was absolutely indispensable in getting this out. And finally, our publications department, who promised me the report would physically be here on time, and they delivered, and I'm really grateful for that. We have actually a couple of other members of our delegation who are here, so let me mention Bob Witajewski and Joseph Skinner, who also came with us for the Taiwan portion. Not everybody who went to Taiwan actually joined us on the mainland. So let me begin by giving a very brief definition of confidence-building measures. There's lots of different ways to define it. The way we defined it, it was fairly broadly that it involves both formal and informal measures that address, prevent, or resolve uncertainties among parties. And thus, in the case of military CBMs, reduce the possibility of incidental or accidental conflict, and in the case of both military and non-military CBMs, increase mutual understanding and trust. And although we did spend a considerable amount of time focusing on military CBMs, we also talked about confidence building in non-traditional security areas, and there is a section on our report that deals with environment and health issues that perhaps might be ripe for cooperation between the two sides of the strait and might in some ways be easier than some of the military CBMs. I am going to focus first on military CBMs, which is an issue that I've been discussing actually with officials, military officers, and experts on both sides of the strait for about 7 years. This is the first time that I was able to convince the mainland to allow me to bring a delegation of experts explicitly to discuss this issue, just American experts. Nobody from Taiwan came with us. We have yet to be able to get both sides in the same room to talk about military CBMs, but I hope to do that sometime in the future, or maybe they could do it without the Americans, which is fine, too. There's no essential need for the United States or even American just scholars to be in the room. But I felt that was really a breakthrough. I think it really demonstrated that there is great interest on the mainland side in confidence building across the strait. And I think it's not just understanding what the Americans think, but also understanding Taiwan perspectives. Well, we were in Taipei first, and we did meet with then-president-elect Ma Ying-jeou. And he talked about the agenda of issues that he had that he wanted to pursue with the mainland and the order in which he wanted to pursue them. Of course, the initial set of issues on the agenda really comprise the set of economic issues that we already see being implemented. The second set of issues involves what is usually referred to as international space or Taiwan's participation in the international community. And the third is really military and security issues. And I think that for both Ma Ying-jeou and Hu Jintao, there is an important role for CBMs down the road, military confidence-building measures, as part of a long-term peace and security framework. So this is something that that leaders on both sides of the strait have talked about. And there is considerable research that has been done. On the Taiwan side, really this started actually early in Chen Shui-bian's administration. There was considerable research done on military confidence building. For those of you who've seen the defense white papers from 2002 and 2004, there's a lengthy section on possible short-term, medium-term, and long-term CBMs with the mainland. On the PRC side, much of this research is less public. But there are parts of the PLA, for example, in the Academy of Military Sciences, where there's a Center for Taiwan Studies that has done considerable research on this topic, also at the National Defense University, and some civilians are involved in this work as well. When Taiwan, under Chen Shui-bian's leadership, put forward some of these proposals on military CBMs, there was really no receptivity and very little interest at the time in making a response on the mainland side. And I think that was primarily because as long as Taiwan was pursuing independence, confidence-building measures were essentially seen as contrary to Chinese interests. At the time, many people said to me, we really would like Taiwan to be insecure, not secure, not so confident, to continue down the path that they perceived of as provocative, moving towards potential de jure independence. So there was attention paid to some of these proposals, certainly not agreement on all of them, but there was no official response. But the mainland nevertheless understood that when and if cross-strait political dialogue were resumed, the efforts to end hostility across the strait would ensue, and then military CBMs would be explored as part of that process. So I think it was really based on that understanding that the Chinese agreed to host us. It was interesting that they actually agreed. We set this up in January, even before the election outcome was known, at a time when there was great anxiety on the mainland about the outcome of this election. But they nevertheless agreed and had permission from various units, including the PLA and I'm sure the foreign ministry, to allow an American delegation to come talk about cross-strait CBMs. So I'd like to summarize, if I could, from our discussions on both sides of the strait about this issue, And there is considerable overlap between both sides in their thinking, what the objectives of military CBMs might be. And there are obvious divergences, and I'll point to some of those too. I would say that both sides attach great importance to establishing contact between the two militaries. After all, the two sides of the strait have been estranged for almost 60 years. We have seen a great deal of interaction now in the last decade in particular among businessmen, people who are engaged in even their cultural issues there, some lower representatives from the government, party ties, obviously, between the KMT and the Chinese Communist Party really getting underway in 2005, tourists now from the mainland going to Taiwan, all sorts of interaction between these two societies. Very little between the two militaries. The only interaction that that I know of is a few retired military officers from Taiwan going over to the mainland, sometimes to participate in conferences or have a few meetings, sometimes perhaps not even going with the approval of their government. And there has been no official interaction between the two sides, certainly no exchange programs. So both sides are interested in developing these relationships, networks, and exchanges so they can increase their knowledge base and enhance understanding. Examples of CBMs that I think both sides were on board with was something like establishing a cross-strait retired senior officers forum and beginning exchanges between staff colleges, military academies, maritime agencies, Coast Guard, the kinds of things that that militaries really do all over the world. The second objective, which some people might have expected would be at the top of the list, was to avoid dangerous military activities and reduce the chance of accident. I think we found, and I have found this to be consistent in my discussions with the militaries on both sides of the strait, they have been obviously closely observing each other for quite some time, and they believe that they know each other's rules of engagement. They do not believe that there is a great risk of accident. If there were an accident, they think that the chances of that escalating out of control and becoming a broader military conflict are very, very slim. So neither really perceive that CBMs are critical to avoid air and ship collisions. I would say that there have been significant instances in the past where we have had fighters that have been behaving in rather aggressive ways, particularly on the PRC side, when trying to send a political signal to the other side. Accidents indeed could happen. I recall when the EP3 incident took place in 2001, there was a lot of concern on the part of the Taiwan military. If we couldn't get on the phone and get somebody to answer it on the other side, well, they certainly wouldn't know who to call or how to do it. So I think there's a recognition on both sides. Unwanted accidents could occur, even though they don't assess the likelihood as very high. And if they did, an incident certainly could cause maybe political tensions to spike. So, again, examples of confidence-building measures in the military sphere, individuals, and again, I mean individuals, this certainly does not represent government thinking, there's interest in maritime safety agreements, something like incidents at sea agreements that have been negotiated around the world that would formalize rules of the road at sea and in the air so that the chances of collision are reduced. Now, the Taiwan side seeks greater transparency. Taiwan has been publishing in advance the exercises, military exercises that it conducts for quite a number of years and believes that that would be a good CBM for the mainland to announce in advance the scope, the location, the duration of their exercises. That's something at least one individual that I talked to in the mainland side thought actually might be difficult, but not something that they would rule out. And, of course, Taiwan would also like greater military budget transparency, which is something I think both the United States, Japan, and also other countries have called for. there was a lot of interest in Taiwan and I think also on the mainland in the establishment of separate air corridors for commercial aviation, for military aircraft. Interest in this is really greatly enhanced by the agreement on direct flights, which will probably soon be conducted by the shortest, the most direct route rather than through Hong Kong airspace. And so that is another area where CBMs could be useful. And finally, I would say that there's interest in military hotlines, not the kind of hotline that we have between the United States and China at higher levels of defense establishments, but looking more at a model like China is establishing with South Korea, operational hotlines at sea and with naval commanders. The third objective for military CBMs that both sides were interested in was mutual, essentially beneficial cooperation. And examples of this would be joint exercises, for example, to develop joint emergency response capacity. If you had an airliner, for example, that went down and in the strait, you had to send forces on both sides or humanitarian rescue, that they would be able to operate together. So conducting things like search and rescue exercises was something that both sides were interested in. And also, there's really an interest, I would say, in formalizing and expanding law enforcement cooperation, where there's a good deal of informal and cooperation that goes on now, particularly on areas like drug smuggling, human smuggling, providing assistance to fishermen in the strait. This could be expanded, it could be formalized, and it could involve even counterterrorism efforts. So that's what I wanted to say on the military CBM issues. I wanted to say a little bit on international space, and then I will close by addressing some of the recommendations. What has been achieved so far between Taiwan and the mainland since the new government took office in Taiwan has been relatively easy, in part because they're dealing with economic issues and also because a great deal of progress was made in the negotiations for the charter flights and for Chinese tourists under the Chen Shui-bian administration. The next round of talks will likely be December when Chen Yunlin, the head of ARATS, goes to Taiwan. And as I'm sure you all know, there's a discussion of making these flights daily, eventually making them scheduled, and dealing with the issue of direct cargo flights. The next phase will really begin next spring, probably in May, that will address the issue of Taiwan's participation in the international community. And what I have heard in my many discussions with mainland Chinese, and I think this is what we heard on our visit in April, was really quite similar to the way Ralph characterized it, that this is exceedingly difficult for China to accept any Taiwan participation in an organization, an international organization that requires sovereignty for membership, they see as part of an effort to create two Chinas, one China, one Taiwan, or at the minimum, to strengthen Taiwan's de facto independence. This is, in their view, very much linked to the dispute about the dispute over sovereignty, which they claim both sides have agreed to shelve. And allowing to Taiwan to participate in activities that don't or organizations that don't require sovereignty for membership is possible. But any UN-affiliated organization there, I think, is great reluctance. Why did I mention next May is the turning point? This is when the World Health Assembly meeting will be held. And President Ma has made essentially a litmus test of Chinese sincerity on this issue, the acceptance by Beijing of Taiwan as an observer to the World Health Assembly. I have found, and this is what we heard last April, I've since visited the mainland twice. And I have found that there is a lack of appreciation for how important this issue is to the people of Taiwan, and how this could really send the cross-strait relationship south, at least result in a stalemate, if not maybe setbacks, if the mainland does not respond more positively. And so I hope that both sides will find a way to manage this issue in a way that will continue the process of easing tensions between the two sides. My view is that China should be more magnanimous on this issue. Winning over the hearts and minds of the people of Taiwan, at least, is a rhetorical goal, and I think this is a critically important issue. Finally, I want to turn to the issue of policy recommendations, and I won't read what we have written in the report. I just want to highlight a couple of them. The United States has expressed firm support for the process of easing cross-strait tensions, and I think this is extremely important. I think we should continue to do so. But I believe that we have to do more. I think that there are persisting suspicions on both sides of the strait, that the United States sees danger in this process, worries about Taiwan mainland reconciliation, and might even take actions to impede it. And so I think that there's more that we need to do to dispel these suspicions. Any solution, I believe, that is reached by both sides, that is reached through voluntary choice without coercion, I think would serve U.S. interests, and I think that any U.S. government would not stand in the way. And so I think we need to do more to get that message across. Secondly, until there is a peace accord between the two sides, which in a minute Phil Saunders will talk more about, until there really is a fundamental change in the security situation across the Taiwan Strait, which, of course, we hope for but is not inevitable, the maintenance of U.S.-Taiwan security ties are critically important for American interests. And this includes arms sales. To bolster, I believe, Taiwan's defensive capabilities, this is very much part of our commitments and our legal obligations in the Taiwan Relations Act. At least in the near term, I would argue that this relationship, arms sales being a component of it, serves not only American and Taiwan interests, but also Chinese interests. Taiwan is not going to go to the negotiating table, nor should it, if it feels vulnerable and insecure. So I hope that all parties will take a long-term view of this, and especially Beijing, and not overreact and read things into to U.S. arms sales, such as that they indicate support for U.S. independence of Taiwan, or, again, that it means that the U.S. is trying to slow down the process of any reconciliation between the two sides. Thirdly, and this is a recommendation for the mainland that I think is important, I think that Beijing needs to take advantage of the perhaps what I'd call the post-Olympic boost in its confidence to do more in the interests of the Taiwan people. And this is really across the board, economically, diplomatically, and militarily. As Ralph said at the outset, this is an opportunity that should not be missed. And finally, let me say something about Taiwan's policy. I think it's extremely important to continue that the efforts be continued on the part of Ma Ying-jeou and the current government to seek a domestic consensus on policy toward the mainland. As difficult as this may be, it is very important going forward. The DPP must not be excluded. It must be brought into the process of reconciliation with the mainland. And in addition to that, Taiwan should continue to consult closely with the United States. One of the expressions that always goes when we talk about U.S.-Taiwan relations is that we don't want any surprises, it's important going forward that we talk to each other, governments, but also the publics and scholars about how we see the situation changing between Taiwan and the mainland, the broader security situation in Asia, what expectations Taiwan should have for the new government that will come to power here next year. There's a whole range of issues that we should be continuing to talk about. And I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Before turning to Phil, I'd like to add just one additional comment on the arms sales issue. This is personal opinion, it's also I will sort of try to couch this in very careful terms, not to send the wrong message. I mean, the Chinese have three talking points on arms sales to Taiwan. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever. And that's very clear. And when you talk to the Chinese, you hear one, two, and three over and over and over again. But there was also a sense, quite frankly, back in April, a view that if the U.S. was going to do arms sales, the best time for an F-16 announcement would have been prior to May 20th. That, of course, is now OBE'd. But also a sense that the second best time would be prior to January 20th of 2009, that it would be much better, again, not today, not tomorrow, not ever, but if it's going to happen, it would be much better for it to be associated with the U.S. political campaign than to have the next administration, whoever that is, start off with an F-16 sale as one of the first things to define its relationship with China and Taiwan. I throw that out as sort of my own personal observation and recommendation on this. I have not heard a lot of receptivity here in Washington to that idea or that view, but I think it is something that's at least worth kicking around. Let me now turn to Phil.
Great, and it's a real pleasure both to be here today and to have participated in what was a very interesting trip and set of discussions. I guess I've been working with Bonnie on CBMs and the cross-strait conflict for probably 5 or 6 years now, and have learned a great deal from her and was delighted to have the chance to go along on this trip. What I'm going to do is talk a little bit about what I see as President Ma's strategy, which he has articulated as culminating in a peace agreement, talk a little bit about what a peace agreement might look like, not dwell on that too much, but then relate it back to the issue of CBMs and how they might fit into a confidence-building a peace agreement and some of the tensions, I think, between the political strategy that President Ma is following and some of our research on this. And again, as Ralph said, I'm speaking as in my scholarly private capacity, not as a U.S. government employee. And one of the interesting things about the trip was President Ma articulated to our group, as he has done in public, that he has a definite phased strategy for dealing with the mainland. Part of that is to start with an emphasis on economic issues, to use the establishment and improvement of cross-strait relations to improve Taiwan's economy and boost its growth rate, build upon the easy steps there to work for an economic agreement, and then to start tackling the harder political and military confidence-building measures culminating in a peace agreement. And it's worth noting, perhaps, that this is kind of a step-by-step, gradual accumulation of process. He wants both to build trust between the two sides of the strait, but he also wants to demonstrate to a somewhat skeptical Taiwan public and certainly a very skeptical opposition that he can manage this relationship properly in a way that makes Taiwan both more prosperous and more secure. So that is his strategy. He sees this as culminating in a peace agreement of some kind, and Beijing has also talked about a peace agreement as one of their objectives in the Party Congress. And I notice in the audience we have Ken Lieberthal, who has written about what an interim peace agreement might look like, and that was indeed part of our inspiration for trying to flesh that out a little bit. So when we say a peace agreement, what we don't mean is a permanent resolution of the issue. I think there is a consensus on both sides of the strait that the time is not ripe for this, that you can't resolve Taiwan's final status today. So instead, what you are looking at is something short of that, but something that stabilizes the situation for at least a certain time. And the core agreement there is a commitment by Taiwan not to declare independence and a conditional commitment by Beijing not to use force while that holds. So that is the core of any peace agreement, but there's a lot of variations and things that might be added on top of that. And at least our research, research that I've done with Scott Kastner from the University of Maryland, suggests that how you put this together and what is included matters an awful lot in how well it works. I won't go through the whole of this, but in our paper we talked a little bit about the form, who would be the parties to an agreement, and what capacity would they negotiate. What's the form? Is it an oral agreement? Is it joint communiques? Is it something more formal than that? How specific is it? Is it a vague statement of principles, or does it really get into details? What's the duration of it? And especially importantly, what is the scope? Is it confined to this core bargain, no declaration of independence, no use of force, or are there other things that are put on top of it, including CBMs? And I think our analysis suggests that, that's a really important dimension of this. Again, in the paper, and I won't go through it all, we talk about mechanisms by which this might matter, but just briefly, that an agreement is a way of committing the sides in such a way that if they break it, they would pay a significant international cost for doing so. Especially for Taiwan, an agreement might bind them by putting some domestic constraints. So if it is something ratified by the legislature or ratified by referendum, it could be a more binding instrument. It reduces uncertainty about what the other side is doing. Every day you see them complying with the agreement is a day you're pretty sure they're not either going to declare independence or attack. And finally, it might facilitate cooperation that might not be available outside an agreement and potentially get a new cross-strait dynamic going. And one of the questions we thought about a lot is, well, can't you do all that bit by bit? Can't you do little steps here and little steps there? Or is there some special value to tying it all up into a bigger bundled peace agreement? And I think our conclusion was there is some value to tying it up in a bigger peace agreement. And let me just speak to that a little bit. One of the possibilities is that you can do linkages across issues. So there may be things that one side really wants, yet if you were just negotiating about an economic issue or an international space issue, and that's the only context of a negotiation, it might be very hard to reach an agreement. But if you've got a bigger package, you can do a linkage across. It might be the case that the only way you can really get a compromise on some tough issues like international space or some really significant military CBMs is if it's in a bigger package and if there are some significant political concessions that the other side is getting. So you only get that kind of ability to really compromise if it is a bigger deal. So you might not be able to solve that issue on its own, but when it is linked or it's packaged, you might be able to make more progress on it. Another way of thinking about this is how do you build a domestic coalition in support of this agreement? This is something that clearly is very, very important for Ma Ying-jeou in thinking about this. And he doesn't want a 50% plus one. He wants something that has broader support. And again, if you are bundling not just this core agreement, but have some economic packages, you're getting some international space, you are getting some CBMs that really do make Taiwan more secure, and maybe you're getting some changes in China's military modernization, that may be a package that can build a much broader political coalition. It's also worth noting that there may be some things that you can only do in the context of an agreement. And one of the interesting ideas we came up with in the paper was talking about something we called identity goods. And basically the notion here is that in the context of an agreement, the Taiwan government might give China a greater chance to make its case for why it sees unification as a good thing, a greater chance to make that case to the Taiwan people. And on the other side, a Taiwan government that sees democracy or greater liberalization in China as a precondition for even thinking about unification might get a chance to articulate that case in China. That's a pretty far-sighted notion, but that's not something that is going to happen on its own, and it might be something you could get within an agreement. And then finally, another thing we thought about was if you have a bundled agreement, that may make it easier to ensure compliance because you've got different parts. Some are economic, some are political, some are military CBMs. And if you start cheating on one part of it, you put the whole agreement at risk. And so not only does that risk these bigger things, but you might lose some economic benefits that people on your side care about a lot. So this can also be something of a binding mechanism there. Now, of course, there's lots of obstacles to this that I won't go into too much. But I think the key thing is that it's worth thinking about in more specific terms how this might work and what role CBMs might play. And let me draw out, in closing, two kind of counterintuitive conclusions from this. One thing we certainly heard on the trip and have heard from other Chinese delegations is concern about, well, if they make concessions on issues such as international space, what if there is a DPP government that comes back to power in 4 years and takes advantage of those to push for independence? And I think one finding of this research trying to think about what a peace agreement might look like is actually China has some incentives to do an agreement that is more formal, that is perhaps signed with Taiwan, not just in the party capacity or personal capacity, but in a way that binds that government, to make it more binding and to make it more valuable to Taiwan, so that if a future Taiwan government were to walk away from a peace agreement, they would be giving up a lot of things. They would be giving up significant military CBMs, significant economic benefits, significant stability. And so a PRC that is generous about what it agrees to might be more able to bind a future Taiwan government. And then the other question or thought that comes out of this research questions this incremental strategy. Yes, that is an important way to try to build trust and build political consensus on Taiwan and political support for an agreement. But if you do it bit by bit, you're giving away some bargaining chips that you might need for a bigger agreement. You don't have this ability to try to build a domestic coalition and to bundle issues and to work the linkages across issues. And at the end of the day, you might not have enough there in the core agreement to really get there. So it's not so much that how President Ma is going about it is the wrong way, but just to point out that there's a tension between this incremental approach that builds support and the desire at the end of the day to have an agreement that is big enough and bundles enough stuff together so you get the domestic benefits of building a coalition and you build an agreement that may have a greater chance to last over time. Let me stop there.
Good. Thank you, Phil. At this point, I'd like to open it up for general discussion for your questions. I would ask you to identify yourself, indicate who you want to address your question toward, and try to be as clear and concise as possible. We hope your questions won't be longer than our presentations, for instance, which is always helpful. Right. Sir.
I'm Mike Fonte. I work as a consultant to the Democratic Progressive Party. Dr. Tsai Ing-wen was here last week talking to a variety of people, and she raised the question of cross-strait issues, of course, and the concerns the DPP has. It seems to me the major concern at this point is the issue of political concessions that seem already to have been made by the Ma administration. One phrase that comes to mind that she raised was the question that, in the course of talking about suicide rates, Ma was talking to a group and he said, well, the rates have gone down in the Republic of China, Taiwan region. A strange phrase to the DPP. I think this is the issue that I would, you know, wonder if you had a chance to explore. That is, what is Ma's presupposition about a cross-straits agreement in terms of this so-called special relationship he has talked about instead of a state-to-state relationship. It seems to me that's the crux of the question that the DPP wants to see faced.
I didn't read the comment that you referred to that Ma Ying-jeou said, so I won't comment specifically on that. I did read, of course, that he referred to the relationship as a special relationship, not a state-to-state relationship, which his predecessor had called it. Though at the same time, he continues to say that Taiwan is an independent sovereign state, and that's somewhat contradictory. If it's an independent sovereign state, it really is a special, or it is a state-to-state relationship. I find, at least my interpretation of what Ma Ying-jeou is doing, is that he is trying not to poke a finger in the eye of the other side. So he talks about things like mutual non-denial, for example, and a diplomatic truce of keeping each side's respective allies. I mean, this is a dance that is very difficult, but I think he's making an effort. And I would say that there are some efforts being made on the Chinese side too. So I'm not so sure that I would agree with Tsai Ing-wen's characterization that the Taiwan side is making all the concessions and Beijing is not. I recall, for example, the concerns that were expressed by Taipei, including by the KMT chairman Wu Bo-xiong, just before the Olympics, about whether or not they would use, China Taipei or Chinese Taipei, Zhongguo Taipei or Zhonghua Taipei. And originally the mainland side seemed to say, oh, it really doesn't matter. We'll just let our media use whatever they want, and it was made clear by the Taiwan side that was not acceptable. And so, the decision was made in Beijing that they would stick to the language that Taiwan wanted to and that they had agreed to, which is always used in the Olympics traditionally, of Zhonghua Taipei, having Chinese Taipei. So, I see both sides trying to walk this very, very sort of careful line, and particularly on Ma's side, trying not to set back progress and create difficulties for going forward, because it's very easy to get derail this whole process. I appreciate the fact that there is a constituency within Taiwan that is particularly concerned about Taiwan's independence, though I think it's a very large number of people who want the status quo, if not independence. They don't want reunification. They are sort of holding Ma's feet to the fire, and one might say that that's what the people should do and what a good opposition should do as well to ensure that Taiwan's interests are protected. But I think going forward, it's not a bad thing that Ma is trying to be somewhat cautious about what he's saying. I'm not sure I would see it all as political concessions.
I would just add very briefly to that two points. One is that certainly Ma is aware of these concerns. When he talked to us, his number three priority was improving cross-strait relations. Number two priority was improving relations with the U.S. Number one priority was essentially building a domestic consensus for his programs and for trying to allay the concerns of the opposition. Hence his, three no's, not only no independence, but no unification. The flip side of that, and I think Barney would verify this, or Mike Lampton and others who have spent a lot of time in China, is 3 or 4 years ago, we would get lectures from the Chinese about how the Taiwan identity was all a Chen Shui Bian trick. But today, I think there is a much better understanding on the mainland for the limitations of any KMT government, that this is not your father's KMT. While they love to hear what Lien Zheng and others have to say when they come, they understand that this represents a political force that is really no longer prevalent. So I think there's a much more realistic understanding on the mainland side as to just how much they can expect, how far they can push, and I think that this will also sort of help make a more of a realistic agreement at the end of the day. That's my sense anyway. This gentleman here, and then we'll go to that lady next.
My name is Liu Shizhong from the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies at Brookings. I want to comment a little bit on Philip's last point. If I remember, if I hear you correctly, you say something like with respect to the possibility of President Mao and his government to sort of not to use the domestic consensus to negotiate with the others, because by generating domestic consensus, it might put in a way more of his bargaining chips. We've seen this many, many times in the past couple of years, even during the DPP's President Chen's term. My feeling is that it's not like, I totally agree with you that there's a severe concern from the Chinese side that, well, maybe President Ma is not going to last for the next 3 years. Maybe DPP will come back, and then, like you said, the DPP might take advantage of that, some kind of a bargaining result. But if we take a look closer back to what happened a couple of years ago, especially going back to the first term of President Chen Shui-bian, in the very beginning of his first term, there are some sort of at least a chemistry for negotiation going on, but the Chinese have been watching closely on President Chen's domestic support. As long as it continued to drop, then they will create more barriers, and the Chinese will feel more reluctant to deal with that, or maybe to make further concessions. And you met President Ma when he was still president-elect. I think that's the key point, the key timing. I mean, after 3 months of a government, at least after the 100 days, right now his approval rate is like, I'm not saying it's under 30, at least under 40. That's for sure. I think everybody in this room agree with that. So what I'm trying to say is that Chinese will watch very carefully on how President Ma deal with this domestic situation, given the fact that the economy might further deteriorate, and this typhoon just hit Taiwan and left a lot of burdens for the government. So what I'm trying to ask is that, to what extent do you see from the Chinese, in your observation on Chinese reaction to Ma Ying-jeou's capability to bring more bargaining chip on this negotiation table? And
boy, that's a tough question. One element of Ma's strategy was that he wanted to reestablish the semi-official ties and work on the economic agenda and produce concrete benefits which would then build domestic support. And I think the problem is there's been a global economic slowdown which is swamping all of that, all of those things that he hoped would pay off and raise Taiwan's growth rate. Instead, they're being swamped by bigger global economic trends which are slowing growth rates throughout Asia and really affecting Taiwan. So that is that's one question about the strategy, is he's not getting the payoff that he had hoped, and hence not the domestic economic support. And so that raises a question about how effectively can he move forward. However, really your question is about PRC calculations, about do they do better with a Taiwan president who is popular and has support, or if his support seems to be declining, do they just wait and then try to negotiate from a weakened position? And in this case, I think they have incentives to try to deal with him, not to wait, because I suspect a weakened Ma is even less able to deliver. I mean, this is, I think, one of the differences between the arguments that many of the Americans in the delegation made, was that it is in China's interest for Ma to succeed, and that they should look for ways to strengthen him and deliver things, not just that he wants politically, but that people on Taiwan want. And that ought to be their focus. So I don't think a weakened Ma is better for China, and I don't think that's the way it's viewed from the Chinese side either.
And of course, if you're sitting in Washington or Seoul, a 40% popularity is almost a sweeping mandate. So it's
can I just add one thing?
Yeah, well, go ahead. And then Nadia. Yes. Go ahead, Bonnie.
I just wanted to add one quick point. Immediately after Ma Ying-jeou's election, and when, again, we were there in April, I found that the reaction of almost all the people that we talked to was great relief that Chen Shui-bian would be leaving office, and a sense that they could adopt once again a wait-and-see attitude towards this new president, that they did not have to reach out and do very much to help strengthen Ma's position. And people cited all sorts of reasons, just as you have now. And at that time, yes, Ma's support level was much higher than it is today. But they said, oh, his ability to control his own party is in question. Certainly the opposition is not going to support him. And therefore, I remember one senior scholar saying, we should not have high expectations of Ma Ying-jeou. And so we have to seriously consider how much we really want to do. And at that time, I think there really was an intense debate on this question. Well, it was after our visit that Hu Jintao met with Wu Bo-xiong and made statements indicating that Beijing does have responsibility for the outcome of the development of the cross-strait relationship, for that process, and specifically on the World Health Organization issue, which was being discussed at the time. And so I sense that, although I think I agree with you that the mainland side is very closely observing the domestic situation, that they nevertheless are not going to take that hands-off attitude that perhaps some had wanted to, because they perceive that the leadership in China does not want to follow that path, and that they see that they can play a role in influencing, not solely determining, but influencing Ma Ying-jeou's position in Taiwan. And they, for the time being, I think, see it in their interest at least to take some measures. The question is whether it's enough.
Yeah. Okay. Nadia Chow with Liberty Time from Taiwan. My question is that you know, during the past year, we heard a lot of Chinese scholar officials said they were, you know, actually consider all kind of possibility concession or you know arrangement for international space. For Taiwan, the only reason that they don't want to give it to DPP government. Now, with the new government, you know, came back to office. I wonder, when you talk with the Chinese, have you think they really thought through this, or they just start thinking about it? Because they should prepare for this for a long time. And if, you know, they refuse to make a concession on international space, have they thought about the, you know, worst scenario, or they are ready to, you know, for that worst scenario? Because there's a, you know, not much they will lose, so they will stick with their principle, even though they might sour the chemistry. And from the U.S. side, we heard, say, you know, Secretary Rice used, I gave a short comment to Wall Street Journal when he, you know, was doing the interview. He said, she said that the U.S. want to see Taiwan have a real international space in the, you know, in international community. So I wonder, with the outgoing government and next year will be a new government busy with, you know, domestic issues, what can U.S. do in this regard? And before the relationship really gets sour, you know, were there any role that U.S. can play? Thanks.
I think that China has, in fact, thought quite seriously about the international space issue and are, I think, struggling with how they can give Taiwan some participation that will address some of Taiwan's concerns without giving away the store. Without allowing participation in organizations that require sovereignty for membership, because this is, as I said earlier, their core concern. My worry here is that they will miscalculate, that there will be perhaps a narrowing between what Taiwan's expectations and demands are and what China is willing to give. I don't expect that gap to close, and that's why I really worry that this issue could set back the relationship. But there, just to give you one example of the kind of thinking that has taken place on the mainland, is on the issue of observership or observer status, not just in the World Health Assembly, but in other organizations and the UN General Assembly itself. And the mainland is studying what implications it would have if they were to permit Taiwan to have the observer status of the World Health Assembly, then what are the implications for observer status in other organizations? They're very concerned about setting a precedent, and then Taiwan will want to be an observer everywhere. So they're concerned about this sort of slippery slope. Some people are asking, can we do this for the World Health Assembly in a way that is a unique solution, doesn't set a precedent for other organizations? Those are the people who are being more creative, who are looking for a way to make progress on this issue. But I think the vast majority, as I said, are just very concerned about the sovereignty issue and are hoping to address Taiwan's concerns by providing some opportunities to participate, more opportunities to participate in World Health Organization activities, possibly through the MOU that was signed between the mainland and the secretariat of the World Health Organization. And that's a question, again, I think Taiwan's government has said nothing about whether it will demand that that MOU be scrapped or whether it is somehow willing to work through that MOU. But these are issues that I think they are being discussed on the mainland. What has not taken place, as far as I understand so far, is the real beginning of serious discussions or negotiations between the two sides, either in the party channel or in the CEF ARATS channel. So you may have a few scholars sort of on both sides talking about this. But this, as I understand, is not on the agenda for the December planned visit by Chun Yun Lin. So as we approach May, the possibility of reaching some kind of solution here, some that would address Taiwan's needs and also China's concerns, they become rather remote if we don't have opportunities for the two sides to really discuss them seriously.
Yeah, I would add to that I don't think it's a problem of the people on the mainland haven't been thinking about it. In some cases, I think they're overthinking about it, and the focus has been on the worst-case thinking, yeah. On sort of, you know, where's if A, then B, then C, then E, and sort of talking them out of every option just by looking through all the worst cases, as opposed to trying to be a little bit more creative. And the second aspect, which I think we touched on earlier, was the lack of any sense of urgency on the mainland side. There's still sort of this view that, you know, the crisis is over now. We can all take a deep breath. No one's going to pull away the fig leaf of one China. Therefore, we can sort of take it easy and not and just concentrate on the low-hanging fruit, on sort of the easier things, and push everything else down the road. And if there's been one message that in several of the different forums that I've been at that people have tried, and people from Taiwan, I think, have tried to emphasize to the mainland, is that this isn't a place where a 5 or 10 year solution is going to be worked out. There has to be some deliverable, some tangible benefits that the Taiwan people have to feel in the next 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, if this is going to be sustained, or else there will not be the political support within Taiwan to sustain it. And I don't know how that message is being given to Beijing, how much it has been taken on board and how much it is driving the decision-making process, I think, is still a question. Excuse me? Well, I think that my view has always been nothing makes things worse than U.S. efforts to make them better. Sometimes our best role is to sort of be supportive, but not to put ourselves in the middle. And certainly in the middle of a presidential campaign, the last thing you want to do is get a lot of bright U.S. Pronouncements about how we're going to solve the problem. I think we were very fortunate. We sort of dodged a bullet on U.S.-China relations that nothing particularly bad happened during the Olympics that would force either one of the candidates to make strident comments. And hopefully cross-strait issue will be another one of those areas that both candidates will have an opportunity to not comment on between now and January, and we'll all be better served if that's the case. Yes, this gentleman.
John Zan with CTI TV of Taiwan. My question is, are conditions ripe for us to talk about CBM now? Because if the two sides of the Taiwan Strait cannot find any common ground on Taiwan's international space, everything positive, well, not everything, probably most of the things that we see positive across the Taiwan Strait may come grinding to a sudden stop. Is this the time really we, you know, should talk about CBM? Or should we discuss, you know, ways to to me, I think a common ground on Taiwan's international space is probably far more important at this stage than to talk about CBM. I just want to get the opinions of the panel. Thank you.
One word answer, yes, but to expand, Bonnie.
Yes, to expand. Yes, as I said at the outset, I think Ma Ying-jeou is absolutely right that first you start with easier things, things that are particularly urgent for Taiwan or steps that will contribute to strengthening Taiwan's economy. I agree that international space is next on the issue. It is more urgent, though many people on both sides of the strait argue that the international space issue is tougher than actually military CBMs and security issues. So is it premature to actually start those negotiations? Yes. Is it premature for people on both sides of the strait to do research, think about it, start developing proposals, priorities to understand how the other side thinks about it? No. I think it's important for both sides. And I think it's especially important, really, for Taiwan. China has been engaged in confidence-building measures with a very large number of its neighbors for many years, India in particular. It has a whole series of confidence-building measures to deal with their relations across that border, the disputed border. There's also CBMs through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Taiwan doesn't have that experience with CBMs. So I think it's very important for Taiwan to do more research, to understand what kind of CBMs might be in their interest, maybe to identify those CBMs that might not be in their interest, to have a list of priorities, what's urgent, what are the things they'd like to do first, what are the things that that perhaps we talked about sequencing of CBMs. If you have to do this step maybe before you pursue something else down the road. And so I think there's a lot of research and thinking that has to go into it. And certainly in the process that we participated in April in discussions that I've had with other people in Taiwan, I think that is going already going on, and it's not premature for that.
Right here.
Just to add on a couple points, that even though a lot of work was done in Taiwan in the previous administration, including some work in the military, you've had a transition of administration, so you've got a new group of senior people, and you've probably had two rotations of officers since that time. So the people that are in the current policy positions and in the current military positions need to think through these issues. And I know that the work that Bonnie has done and that I've participated in a little bit, a significant goal has been making sure that people in Taiwan, both in the military, the government, and the academic community, have sufficient knowledge of how CBMs work and how you negotiate them to decide for themselves what makes sense. So it's definitely not a case where the U.S. has an agenda or we want these CBMs or that. That's not at all an appropriate U.S. role. But what we do hope is that Taiwan, both officials and military and scholars, have a good enough knowledge of how all this works. They can decide for themselves what does and what does not make sense and what their priorities are. That said, I think one thing that came away from the April trip is the opportunity that is coming with the expansion of cross-strait transport links, both air links and sea links. These are things that have been endorsed at a high political level on both sides. As you try to put those into practice, you have practical concerns about how you route the airplanes, how you route the sea, how do you deal with an accident, how do you coordinate these things. And so that's an area where there's both a high-level political endorsement, and you can think about some of these low-level, can think about them as CBMs. You can think about them as just implementing this high-level agreement. And the course of that implementation can provide maybe an entry point for some of these things.
Hi, Peggy Chang with Voice of America China Branch. I was wondering, Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou has been repeating, Bonnie Glaser was saying, that you're putting aside the differences first, putting aside the controversial topic, and then you seek a win-win situation first. But eventually, the two sides have to start talk about political and very difficult discussions. And from your April trip that you were able to talk to both sides, do you see Taiwan side and the China side, that they have a very different idea where this closer economic integration is going to lead to the political discussion? What I mean is that do you see that the Taiwan Ma Ying-jeou has been saying they want to maintain a status quo, but do you think is that what mainland China want to do, or do you still see that they foresee some kind of unification eventually? This kind of differences, I think it will probably affect the political discussion. And plus, DPP and KMT have very different ideas about where this economic integration is leading to as well. And in terms of a political agreement, Ma Ying-jeou will only have 8 years tops. And do you see a political agreement, some kind of peace agreement will be reached or be starting to discuss this kind of agreement in his second term? Thank you.
Well, I think there are differences about where the future relationship is going. On the Chinese side, there is a clear view that where it ought to be headed is toward unification, and that is to some degree a litmus test through which they evaluate all aspects of cross-strait relations. You know, clearly in Taiwan, there's not a consensus on where it is going, and a desire, I think, by many to preserve the status quo, perhaps in a way that keeps options open for the future. So yes, that is a question. That's partly why there has been discussion of an interim agreement that would stabilize the situation for some time, but not try to resolve that fundamental political question of where are things headed. With respect to the question about a political agreement, is it possible within an 8-year term? I think it is potentially possible. You would have to see much more progress on the issues that are being dealt with now, and probably the international space issue, to really get there. And certainly there's some things that President Ma has said are off the table. He's not going to be talking about unification or any final resolution. But I think it's potentially possible. The effort in our case in looking at this is that we noticed both sides were talking about this, but there wasn't any clear picture of what exactly they had in mind. So we wanted to try to examine that and think it through and try to figure out what were some of the issues that might come up in the context of that negotiation so that we could have a little clearer picture of what that might look like.
Let me add that, it's clearly a same bed, different dreams. Which is better than different beds, different dreams, but you're certainly not having the same dream. But my sense is that while no one on the mainland can stand up and say reunification is not the ultimate objective, I haven't heard anyone in a long time say that reunification is a near term, a 4-year, 8-year. I don't think anyone on the mainland expects that unification is going to occur, or that that's even the objective. I mean, the objective for the last couple of years, you can perhaps give Chen Shui-bian credit for turning this around. The objective has been to not preclude unification, to not remove that as a potential option. And as long as that's not removed as a potential option, I don't think that anyone on the mainland right now has a 4 or 8 or 12 or even 20-year plan to see this occur. So I don't think that from that standpoint there's as big a disconnect as one might believe if you just listen to the Chinese rhetoric about unification.
I would just I agree with everything Ralph and Phil have said. I would just add one point, and that is the issue of how the Chinese will use their desire for reunification as potential criteria in evaluating whether they should move forward with certain steps. And this is where I see potential trouble. For example, on the issue of Taiwan's international space, as I said earlier, there's concern that giving Taiwan greater international space in the international community will strengthen Taiwan's de facto independent status. Another way of putting that is that they are concerned about this issue of what Taiwan does or what they grant Taiwan or what they then support Taiwan to do will make reunification more difficult, perhaps even impossible. And so I think that's part of the internal debate in the mainland is whether or not they can support something that in the near term leads to easing of tensions, strengthening of confidence between the two sides, but then make the achievement of the longer-term goal of reunification more difficult. And so I think they're really struggling with that, even though I agree with Ralph that nobody expects reunification in the near term.
Mike Fonte again. Again, I think another concern the DPP has, or at least I have as somebody who has worked with the DPP, is that a potential of these developments across the strait could be a trap for the DPP in this sense. The United States is very supportive of the lessening of tensions. Great. Mr. Ma wants to lessen tensions. The Chinese apparently do. If the terms, the political concessions that I raised before, are not acceptable to the DPP, and they come back into power and then say, hey, all bets are off here, I think that would put them again in the role of troublemaker. I guess that's what I'd love to hear any comments you might have about that.
Let me start, and then my learned colleagues can correct me. But one of the things that has perplexed me in listening to the debate in Taiwan over the last year prior to the election was this fear among many people that I had great respect for as far as their political analysis and insights that somehow or other Ma Ying-jeou would reach some sort of an agreement with the mainland to sell out Taiwan's sovereignty. I have trouble believing that any elected leader would want to do that. B, that in a democratic system and in a political system like Taiwan's, that he would be able to, even if he wanted to. There are still certain checks and balances that, you know, the president just can't sign a declaration that henceforth and forevermore we are a province of China. So while I understand your question sort of in theory, I'm not really sure what kind of agreements Ma would reach with the mainland that the DPP would find it essential to have to undermine. It seems to me that sort of puts the hypothetical so far out in front of what might realistically be accomplished that we may be worrying about the wrong thing. But I'm, you know, again, this is from an outsider's perspective. I don't know if Bonnie, if you want to add to that or Phil.
I would just say that some concerns that people may have in the future in Taiwan about moving closer to the mainland may be valid. And I don't rule out some of the concerns that they have today are valid. But the DPP is going to severely weaken its position if it criticizes every single thing that Ma Ying-jeou is doing toward the mainland. It's sort of like, you know, crying wolf. Every single thing that Ma is doing is bad. And therefore, when there is a more serious concern, I think that it will be more difficult for others to take them seriously, potentially even the United States. And so I think that there really ought to be some deep thinking in the DPP about speaking out in support of what maybe Ma is doing that they can support. Surely the welcoming of tourists was something that was negotiated by Chen Shui-bian. So there's nothing different, except I'm not sure if the cap was 3,000 a day, but there may be some sort of differences on the margins. So I think it really is in the interests of the DPP and in the interests of Taiwan to get some clarity here. What is it that Ma Ying-jeou and his government are doing that they see as having a negative impact on Taiwan's sovereignty?
To add to that briefly, one of the things in thinking this through is that the kind of an agreement a Taiwan president could reach that did not have support, could not be formal and inherently would not be binding. And I think that's something that Ma has talked about, is wanting a legislative ratification of any kind of peace agreement. And then, as I said earlier, that the analysis that we did, at least, is when you go through it, is that the PRC has incentives to make it more formal, more binding, and more generous, precisely because they would hope that it would last over a possible transition between administrations.
Good. I would like to give an opportunity for any last question, and if not, I will go to both of our panelists and ask them if they have any final remarks that they want to make. Well, Phil, let's begin with you, if you have any final words of wisdom.
I will just say that there really are, I think, opportunities here, and it's going to be difficult to realize them, and at the end of the day, I think it will require enlightened leadership on both sides to push beyond kind of established positions. Before the elections, I said in many ways a Kuomintang and Ma Ying-jeou victory would be the most challenging for the PRC because they would have to tear up the policies and routines and incentives that have been in place over the last 8 years and really have to rethink how to deal with Taiwan in a different context. And one way of thinking about what is going on is that that's a big, difficult challenge for them. And I think the report accurately says that it requires high-level leadership because it's not something that is going to bubble up from the bureaucracy. So that's one of the real questions in my mind. I think there are opportunities to stabilize relations across the strait in ways that benefit both sides. But it is going to take creativity and it is going to take leadership to be able to achieve that.
We did not include in our panel today the discussion of the non-traditional security issues, but I would urge you to read that portion of the report. And I do think that going forward that there really are immediate opportunities for the two sides to work together to address some environmental issues and some health issues. China, in particular, in the health area, there are a lot of things that they could do to invite experts from Taiwan to participate in a broad range of multilateral, regional, and international activities that are underway. I think most people in our delegation really saw these as low-hanging fruit, relatively easy things to do. And I see what both sides are engaged in as a process of building goodwill. And what they need to do is build as much goodwill as they can in this period of perhaps the first year of Ma Ying-jeou's presidency. I think after that, some of these issues that they're going to address will be tougher. And they'll need to draw on this reservoir of goodwill as they are dealing with some of these tougher issues down the road. But I do think that both sides do understand that this is a very important strategic opportunity, and that if they do not seize this opportunity and if they mishandle it, that the cross-strait relationship going forward will be very, very uncertain. And I think neither side really wants a return to a very hostile relationship, though the future is uncertain and there's no agreement on the Taiwan side of what kind of a future they want. I still think that most of the Taiwan people really don't want to have a very hostile relationship with the PRC that potentially could put them in a situation where they could be under attack. And so this is really an opportunity that I think that most people on both sides, and certainly the governments now in power on both sides, see. And CBMs are a small part of seizing that opportunity, but I think it's a very important process, and we look forward to continuing our research and our dialogue with both sides of the strait on this.
And finally, to go back to the question about is this the right time for CBMs, and I think part of the answer, part of the reason the answer is yes, is that it creates habits of cooperation. And that it also, in the process of examining CBMs, it will perhaps or hopefully help to identify the current confidence-destroying mechanisms that have been sort of a force of habit on both sides over the last couple of years. The let's call it Taiwan, China. There's no room for that. This is sort of an automatic response among the Chinese that they know is going to be rejected. But let's stop those games now. Let's stop the unnecessary harassment of Taiwanese scholars in track two meetings, and let's stop the 20-minute speech if somebody accidentally uses the word Taiwan in a country in a sentence, and immediately someone from China pops up and gives you the 20-minute lecture on, let's sort of get over these type of things and be a little bit more tolerant and a little bit more flexible. And I think the discussion of confidence building, if the scholars and if the bureaucrats understand that the government thinking now is in identifying ways to cooperate and build confidence as opposed to business as usual, which was the reverse, that in and of itself is going to help to at least eliminate some of the harassment and sort of set the tone for a more positive future. So I would argue that as an additional reason why we need to move forward and seize the opportunity that I think we all see is there. Well, let me thank you all very much for coming on behalf of both CSIS and the Pacific Forum. If you want to be on our respective mailing list, please give us a copy of your email address. And thank you all for coming. Thank you.